welcome back, everyone, to Phantom Galaxy. I'm your host, Nathan Bartleball. I'm joined here with...
Chris Durham.
We're back, everyone. We are sitting here right before Valentine's Day.
And the love is in the air, it's as much as I dread to say it.
Not a lot of love. there's a lot of, what do you call it, platonic love
right now. I didn't mean between us. I mean in general, in the air, as a single bitter man. I hate to say it, but it's everywhere.
But we're sitting here. It's just about Valentine's Day. We're getting back in the swing of regular reviews. Chris and I have been discussing where the podcast is going to go from here. Tonight's episode is going to be another horror-themed episode. And tonight we want to talk about specifically horror movies with a romantic theme.
Yes.
Horror movies that kind of, not just where love is an aspect of the story, but where it's sort of more of the driving force. I think...
where love can pull at the heartstrings and also rip out said heartstrings.
Yes. Yes. I think it's an interesting topic because I think without love at some level in a horror film, I think it's hard to have a movie that can be scary. If you don't have characters that you care about, that care about each other, and that sort of element plays into movies in such a way that it causes us fear and worry and concern when we grow to care about somebody. I mean, that's in the real world too. You know, a lot of anxiety as someone who is married, someone who has kids, my anxiety level, my fear level went up exponentially when I had several other people to care about or be concerned about. But I think when we talk about Valentine's Day, we're talking about something that can almost be an anathema because we're talking about romance, romantic love, and the kind of feelings that romance as a genre kind of stirs up and how that kind of dovetails with horror. However, as you and I have discussed, this goes all the way back to the very roots of horror, of genre, if you go as far back as you can go, to the early vampire stories like Bram Stoker's Dracula and Carmilla the Vampire, and all the way back
Frankenstein.
There's a root of the romantic, not just in the way the Victorians referred to romantic, which extends beyond concepts of like love and guy girl relationships and things like that, but romance as a sort of gothic genre. So what we're going to do tonight, specifically talk about movies. I think that's where it's kind of easy to sit down and pick out and say, okay, here are some romantic horror movies. There's certainly a lot of romantic horror novels out there and romantic horror stories in general. I think that there are a lot more the more you think about them, but I would say there's only a handful that are probably easily pressed into that genre mold. Chris, what do
Absolutely.
You think?
As a matter of fact, we even have a specific subgenre now, thanks to this. We have the rom-zom-com, romantic zombie comedy.
I thought you were going to point out the Amish vampire.
Well, that too, but
which apparently exists. I was always hoping to be the first person to write a Amish vampire novel, but they apparently exist, and I'm sure, given the proclivity for people to write Amish romance novels, that these Amish vampires are probably also romance stories. So we've each picked five horror films that we kind of feel, even if these may, I don't think of these five as necessarily my favorite romantic horror movies, rather five that do a nice job, I think, of summing up what I think of when I think about romantic horror. And more specifically, five that I think would make a great viewing for Valentine's Day. As we go along, we'll probably mention others as well. There's a lot that are probably at the very top of the genre that get so much play that it's, you know, I think we figure we can mention them and sort of move on. We
try, even if they're not your favorite, it does kind of fit.
Yeah.
And a lot of people do love them, and everybody's movie tastes are not always the same. So some people may want to check one of these out that we mentioned.
What I think we'll do, we'll just go back and forth and we'll do our top 10. But in between, each one of us will kind of stop and
sprinkle
mention a few
in
others. Yeah, movies as we go along. So I think without further ado, why don't we get right into it? Chris, do you want to start?
Sure. Now, the one I actually want to start with is one of my favorite movies. And I think the reason that it really fits very well here is it is romance, but romance of that's gone really sour, sort of, or perhaps romance started because of relationships going sour. A romance so strong that it involves trying to bring people back from other realities. So I'm talking about Hellraiser from, what was it, 1987? It's quite a while ago. But I love this movie, and it not only is very atmospheric and just the cinematography on stuff that's not even like supernatural is freaky. Like just having these shots of dishes with bugs crawling in and out of them are very gross. But the thing that makes it really fit is the hellish romance, if you will, between Julia, who is who's kind of like the matriarch of this family, and her uncle, her brother-in-law Frank, who she had a little affair with him many years ago. Then he kind of disappeared, and now she kind of has echoes of him in this new house that he moved into. She doesn't know what it's about, and then come to find out Frank had lived there at one point. But anyways, they had this, you know, torrid affair, and so then the supernatural elements of the story kind of kick in, and turns out Frank was out seeking the exotic, seeking beyond what mortal men really want as pleasurable. He wants to see all sides of the coin, so he finds this crazy artifact, and of course there's the puzzle box, which opens up portals to a dimension some might refer to as hell. And he gets sucked in there with the Cenobites that come to get him and torment him for all of time. So basically, the movie's about Julia trying to bring Frank back from this other dimension. She kind of puts some things together, and eventually at one point, her current husband like cuts his hand in the attic or something, and the blood gets drawn into the floorboards of the attic. And then particularly goopy, gory, fantastic sequence, he slowly starts to like this skeletal figure, little bits of bone and marrow kind of form together, little bits of matter here and there, and he kind of reformulates because of the blood that's been dropped where he was taken to hell. So as this kind of goes along, Julia has to seduce men and bring them back to the house so she can continue feeding the floorboards and bring Frank back more and more from the grave or from the other side. And so that to me is a pretty horrifying idea, that there's this woman in this house who's your mother. And she has a relationship with your uncle. And it turns out he's dead, and she's bringing him back to life by bringing in all these unsuspecting victims. It's very twisted romance. I've always enjoyed this one. It's really weird.
It's funny because, I don't think anyone's been able to explain Hellraiser that eloquently to me. And two, while those elements exist, I would have never really pegged it as a romantic horror film. I think mostly because the perspective of the movie tends to be from the perspective of the stepdaughter.
Yeah.
And so as you're watching the movie itself, it's a lot of the stepdaughter trying to figure out what creepy things are going on, and Frank and Julia in the background. However, you make a pretty good case for it being their story.
I say this, that's the thing. I've watched this many times. I love this movie. And I'd say, like, this is the case where you have the villains of the character have this deep romantic relationship. And yes, they are the villains, so ultimately the movie is not their movie. But they build so much in, like, so much of the movie is spent dedicated to them coming back together that I feel it really kind of is their movie.
Yeah, and I don't really argue with that. I think that is the thing that separates movie one from the remainder movies in the series, is that that particular relationship is the closest thing you really get to a human connection for the rest of the movies. I know it mm-hmm. sort of exists in Hellraiser 2, but Hellraiser 2 is just like weird Alice in Wonderland, yes, sort of people running around weird corners. And the Cenobites have the Cenobites, of course, being the demons, these like weird sadomasochistic creatures with the pinhead, of course, being the one that came to prominence here, Doug Bradley, and all that makeup. But they have, what, like 5 minutes of screen time in the first
very
movie?
Short. I mean, really, the most horrific thing about it is like the twisted relationship they have, honestly, yeah, rather than the Cenobites.
The Cenobites are like off stage, sort of like they kind of roll in and they're the judge and the jury and the executioner kind of thing towards the end. They're more like that MacGuffin. So it's an interesting, that I think that's interesting because Clive Barker, in his essence, I think, is largely a romantic horror writer. If you compare him to Stephen King. He has a lot of those elements, yeah. If you compare him to Stephen King, because a lot of Barker's books, I actually find, diverge from being pure horror. I haven't really enjoyed a lot of his later stuff. He, in fact, wrote a novel involving Pinhead that I wasn't a big fan of, but that he did much more recently. But the original Hellbound Heart was an interesting story that has a dark romance. But a lot of his books verge more on dark fantasy, like in Magica and Weave World, and they are essentially love stories. The Great and Secret Show. So it's really not that surprising, but it's an interesting perspective for a series that's sort of just gotten away from itself, that doesn't have that human connection. But yeah, I think Barker's a good example because a movie that made my list was Candyman, Bernard Rose's Candyman from 92, which I think you could turn around and say the same thing to me, that in a lot of ways I don't know that Candyman is a romance, not in its in a typical fashion. Yeah. But I think there's a dark romantic bent to the way the film is, to the way it brings its ideas to the forefront, and the relationship between the central characters is twisted, mostly because of the nature of who they are. It's another story where you've got the supernatural kind of on the sidelines a little bit. The Candyman is this Chicago urban legend who, you've got the killer with the hook on the hand. It seems like Barker is taking a lot of these different urban legend ideas and melding them together. But Candyman has this kind of tragic backstory that goes all the way back to slavery and sort of race relations and that haunted America sort of feel.
That one of the more like sympathetic villains in the horror franchise, I think.
Sympathy. He has a sympathetic backstory, yet Tony Todd, who does a really good job, I think, of playing Candyman. Tony Todd's been sort of typecast as a horror kind of icon now, and
which is crazy. He's like the nicest guy ever.
Yeah, yeah. I saw him a few years back at a restaurant or something.
Corner Stable.
Like, yeah, devouring a blooming onion. Super nice guy, but the way he plays this character is interesting because he's this really kind of tall, imposing African American man, but he's kind of decked out like a pimp. With a hook, for a hand, and yet he's menacing. He's kind of regal, if I can say that. Like
he has a very strong presence.
Yeah, like he's both menacing. He's charming. He doesn't really try to romance the Virginia Madsen character, who's the one who has pulled him from the mirror, you know, who's called his name or whatever and summoned him. But there's a weird kind of tense relationship there between them that you never really know exactly where it's going. And the fact that most of the movie pivots off of them, and Barker is a guy who gives into the kind of the phantasmagoric, which is to say that he doesn't ever deal with normal relationships. It's never something as easy as person A loves person B. Yeah. It almost extends beyond the flesh and beyond, like the Hellraiser idea, and into the soul, which is kind of the only way you can get to the soul is by hacking away at layers of meat. Yeah. I mean, that's almost the way he kind of views it. Like, you want to get the spiritual, you got to go through all this muck first. And that's, I mean, there's some gruesome moments in Candyman. Candyman's a very creepy movie. Bernard Rose is a director. He did also a movie that could be characterized as a romantic horror film called Paper House from the 80s, although it dealt with a young girl and a boy who went into this kind of other reality inside of their minds. Did you ever see Paper House?
No, I haven't.
Bernard Rose also did Immortal Beloved, the movie where Gary Oldman played Beethoven.
Oh, okay.
That had some darker undertones. He's a good director. Candyman's it's also got a really, you talk about good romantic music, it has a really great score by Philip Glass.
Yeah, it does.
I mean, it's just classical, really, in its way. But I think it's a good movie. And Candyman, at least in the first movie, he has some of that same presence that you think of the romantic monsters like Dracula and I wouldn't say Frankenstein so much, but the Phantom of the Opera. There's a little bit of that, even though he's an updated character. So I think Barker, particularly with Candyman and with Hellraiser, sometimes his movies seem a little clunky to me. I'd say these two are good examples of him being able to get his weird vision out there in a way that's compelling. I think both of these are good. If you want to see a horror movie for Valentine's Day, but you don't want to sit there and watch something that's mushy, or is this a story where a guy and a girl fight a monster and that's it? Mm-hmm. I mean, these movies sit outside of that. They're mostly about the villains.
Yeah, absolutely.
They're about the villains, you know, exploring whatever romance is to them.
Which is not something you typically see. So, yeah.
No.
I find it interesting that we both thought of Clive Barker movies, and they're both kind of like from the opposite side of what you'd imagine when you talk about romantic horror movies, like the other side's view of romance.
I think so, yeah. I mean, I think they're both worth your time.
Yeah. So I would guess I'll move on to the next one. So on my list, I would say my second one is a relatively recent one from one of my favorite directors, Guillermo del Toro. This one's not actually one of my favorite movies, but it is just visually very rich. And I'm going to talk about Crimson Peak. You remember going to see that, Nathan?
Yeah, I saw it just last year. Tom Hiddleston and Mia Wasikowski and style.
She has such a unique like face. She kind of melded perfectly with the movie. Mia's, however you pronounce your last name.
And yes, the whole style of the film, she was perfect. She kind of fit perfectly into it.
Mm-hmm.
She was in a version of Jane Eyre a few years back, and that also was like
Crimson Stoker Peak, too.
Stoker as well. Crimson Peak fits into that same sort of mindset, I think.
So this is a case, I think, definitely where, unfortunately, a little bit of style over substance kind of reigned, because it was, like I said, visually very rich. Like, every frame of the movie was just dripping original, like dripping the time period, just really gorgeous to look at. Even like the stuff with ghosts was kind of like just haunting and fascinating to look at. But it's a typical, it's a ghost story. A woman finds a young man. They go to move into his like ancestral estate, and you know, then the hauntings sort of begin. And I don't want to give anything away, but their romance has a bit of trouble towards the beginning and through the movie. And there's another side romance story involved as well. But it plays out kind of like one of those like Victorian love tales a little bit. It has some of the tropes of that pretty strongly throughout. I think, unfortunately, to the detriment of it. Like, it's portrayed more like we're watching one of those novels unfold than we are like a true ghost story.
Yeah, it's kind of very much in the Penny Dreadful sort of mind.
Yeah.
The first 20 minutes or so of the movie really don't even focus much on the horror. Mm-hmm. You really could be watching a sort of Victorian love story.
Yeah.
That maybe has a little bit of the Bronte sisters in there. But
if you want to see something interesting and lavish and very colorful for your Valentine's viewing pleasure, I think this is a very... just interesting thing to look at visually.
Yeah, there's a lot of twisted love in that one too.
Yeah,
there's a lot of.
I don't want to get into it, but yeah,
no, there. Yeah, visually, it is a pretty neat movie to look at,
mm-hmm.
and it captures some of these scenes that if you've ever sat and read one of those old Victorian novels, that Del Toro kind of really relishes making these scenes of something creepy and terrible just scrabbling on the other side of the door. But instead, you know, he's going to show it to us, you know.
And oh, yeah.
We've got a house that literally seems to be oozing its way down into the sediment of the earth, and it's just sinking, and it's in just complete disarray. Well, all the characters seem to be sinking in some kind of moral abyss. The house itself is just
That's a great comparison. Disappearing yeah.
into the ground. I love the way it looked. I agree with a lot of what you said in that I don't know that it came together as a story. Mm-hmm. Like, to me... There should have been that kind of romantic heat that was building in the story between some of the characters like Hiddleston and Wasikowski. Jessica Chastain enters the story. But to me, I just never connected with any of the characters. Like,
exactly.
It rested so much on being this kind of romantic story. I was more involved in it early on when there wasn't any supernatural stuff really happening.
Yes.
When she's first meeting the character of this kind of mysterious baron or whoever who comes into the picture. Mm-hmm. And then from there, it just kind of eventually gets to a point where you're mostly watching it for the visuals, and I wasn't that engaged with the story.
Mm-hmm.
But I agree, and you know, in a lot of ways, that kind of is reminiscent of Bram Stoker's Dracula that Francis Ford Coppola did, where it's just such a visual feast that you sort of stop processing it as a story kind of doesn't matter. I think
that almost made it onto my list.
Yeah, in a way, though, I think Bram Stoker's Dracula, it's one that I would honestly consider sitting down and watching with my wife, kind of, hey, that's a good Valentine's horror movie.
It is.
But I'm not so sure that I'm that engaged with that one either emotionally. It's all about sort of the lavish visuals and the stuff
the opulence
going
of
on.
It.
Yeah, and Del Toro and Coppola have such a strong handle on like what's really theatrical. You know, nothing in either one of these movies feels real, but it just, there's a real dense sense. And there's some gruesome stuff in Crimson Peak. There's a death in there that is just ridiculously, someone's head smashes against a sink and it kind of breaks like porcelain in a way. Which reminds me of another, The Company of Wolves, the Neil Jordan
film. Oh, wow.
That's another very lavish, romantic kind of horror movie. So Crimson Peak's in good standing, I think, with that kind of movie where if you want something that's just really beautiful to look at.
Dreamy and storybook.
Yeah, I just wanted it to go to another level.
Yeah, I did too.
It didn't go there for me.
I don't know, I just thought if you're looking for kind of a visual feast.
Yeah, definitely. And a movie that does, here's the thing about Crimson Peak. It fits more solidly into the mold of what a lot of people, a mainstream, would consider a romantic story. It's got the guy, the girl, the adversity, and the elements of people expect in a romance. Some of the stories we've talked about, Hellraiser, and Candyman already, and even some of the more classic stories, Dracula does have that element too, where there's a strong feeling of the romance storyline in there, in any version of Dracula. Certainly Bram Stoker's Dracula tries to bring it out.
Oh yeah, that's
a bit. But
that was like the primary motive of that one. That film.
So yeah, so Crimson Peak, it's definitely a romance. It has horror and gothic elements. So if that's your thing, it's worth taking a spin. For me, a movie that I think in a way it has its own sense of opulence. I don't think it fits into the groups of movies we've talked about. It's a much older movie, but it's Ugetsu. Chris, have you ever seen Ugetsu?
I have not.
No. That's one we'll have to remedy that. Kenzie Mizuguchi film. It's from 1964, I think. And it's another take on the ghost story that involves a husband who leaves his wife at home, kind of goes out to seek his fortune, and along the way kind of comes across another woman. And then eventually finds his way back to the wife he spurned. And of course there's some dark kind of creepy things going on back at home. If you ever saw the movie Kaidan, the very first time of Kaidan, which is I think the Black Hair is the name of the short story. That base story is the same story that Ugetsu springs from.
I was going to say, it's a very traditional kind of like story in Japanese folklore, kind of.
Well, yes, it is. But what happens is Mizuguchi takes the movie and makes it both... He lessens the supernatural elements of it some, but he makes those supernatural elements feel more dreamy because of what happens. And he centers this more on the drama. So the relationship between the man who leaves and his wife is a much stronger element of the story. And he kind of throws away the kind of gotcha ghost ending, you know, where we want to see the supernatural comeuppance. And he kind of throws that away and spends a lot more time showing the effects of war on these villagers and these lives and things like that. And it's got some really haunting imagery. If you want to see some really great ghostly imagery, boats filled with people just sort of materializing out of the mist. It isn't as lavish as a movie like Kaidan, which was very theatrical, and it lent itself well to like the kabuki sort of theater. In this one, the central ghost story is twisted a little bit, because when the man leaves and goes away from his family, he ends up coming to this sort of mansion, and the woman that he's romancing may or may not even be alive. So that is the kind of the centerpiece, but then when he goes back home, there's things going on there too. It's a beautiful movie. It is very human-centered, which I think is what adds some charm to it. It's definitely going to be light on what you and I would consider straight horror. But it is a ghost story. It is creepy. It does build an otherworldly sense to it. And Mizuguchi is just a kind of director who has such a great handle on images and pacing, and he can make something feel like you're watching a painting sort of unfold. So I'd highly recommend it. I think you would love it. I know you're really into those kinds of movies. Yeah, this is a better movie than that, because The Kaiden is a visual feast, and it has a lot of substance as individual ghost stories. Ugetsu sort of allows you to spend enough time with the characters that you find a little bit more there underneath. There's a lot of like humanity to the story. So I'd say this one's probably really the tip top in terms of, like, if I said you have to go out and watch one movie, I would recommend this. So Ugetsu. Cool. It's one of the movies that for a long time they had it on Hulu. It's not there anymore because it's part of the Criterion Collection. But very, very good, very well worth checking out.
Awesome. I was going to say, okay, so earlier in the podcast I mentioned the subgenre of the rom-zom-com. Well, the movie I'm about to mention kind of coined that phrase, if you will. Rom-zom-com, of course, being a romantic zombie comedy. Shaun of the Dead. If you recall, I believe they actually referred to it as a rom-zom-com.
They made that word up, yeah. Yes.
And it is kind of a subgenre now. You'll see plenty of, like, zombie comedies and romantic zombie comedies now, like independent films and stuff. And this was pretty much the first one and probably still the best one. It was a good, goofy take on reimagining Day of the Dead and adding a unique British spin to it. With the comedy and everything, where you have your slacker guy who works at the printer store or something, and he's just living his life, and he loves going to the bar and taking his girlfriend to the bar, and that's really all he wants out of life, living with his other slacker roommate.
It's the ode to the man child, yeah.
Essentially, yes. And she, of course, being a sophisticated woman, wants nothing to do with it. She's like, you know what, Sean, you're a decent guy, but I want more out of life, you know, than going to the bar every night. So they break up on the eve of what turns out to be the zombie apocalypse. As Sean goes out for one final big rager out at the bar and wakes up the next morning with a splitting headache and people who want to split into his skull and eat the brains. So once he realizes what's going on, of course, he wants to go save his lady and hole up somewhere safe, somewhere where there's drinks, somewhere where there's a gun over the bar. So, of course, he wants to take her to the take everyone to the local bar and hole up there. The Winchester, yes.
Which was a while before there was a Supernatural, the Winchester
bar. Yes, that's right.
But, yes, Shaun of the Dead's a great movie.
It's goofy, it's fun. It's
well known at this point. It's sweet. Not really a horror movie in a lot of ways. I mean, it is.
It's got some pretty grotesque moments.
It has gross moments. I think most of the gross moments are sort of like layered into the comedy. Like, there's a point where someone is still like torn. But my torn point limb is, to limb.
This fits the theme. Oh. And think about this. This is a great one for like a date night movie if your girlfriend doesn't really care for horror movies.
Oh, and that's where I'm coming from. I'm not discounting it. I'm kind of saying that Shaun of the Dead is a movie that's like, it's got the horror elements, it's got the horror feel, but you're not going to sit there watching it between your hands.
Yeah, your significant other's not going to. If for some
reason someone out there hasn't seen this movie, it is a good date night movie. I guess the question becomes, Is the love story between Sean and his girlfriend, or Sean and his buddy? Because it's kind of the buddy.
Why can't it be all three?
I just thought. I mean, I think that the guy girl love story, if they're really being honest about it, it's
the secondary.
It's secondary. It, that's what I was talking about earlier when I say that some horror movies always they have that love element. Like, oh, I care for my family members. I want to see them through this. Mm-hmm. That's kind of what's going on in Shaun the Dead. Like it's the motivating factor to get him to wake up, but the rest of the movie really depends on like just the goofiness of what's going on and kind of the relationship he has with Nick Frost, but it's a totally fun movie.
Yeah, so I think that would be a nice one for you. What do you think? What's your number three? Oh, actually, you know what? Now, before I move on, I want to sprinkle in another one. This one maybe not so everyone's significant other may not care for this one as much because it is a little more horror-related. But, and this one's not a great movie, but Return of the Living Dead 3 is definitely, like, and this one is definitely in the cheese category. I'm only mentioning it simply, and I'm not a huge fan of this one.
This is a bad movie.
It is a bad movie. Specifically, though, it's about a boy whose girlfriend, like, turns into a zombie, and he loves her anyway, and they desperately want to be together. Like, it's an interesting, weird, not that great, but if you're looking for a real zombie movie, this is definitely that, that kind of fits the theme.
Which brings me to, we also have Life After Bath with, did you see this? I've
not heard of that one.
No, no. So Dane DeHaan is in this movie. He's kind of big right now. He's got The Cure for Wellness coming out next week.
That looks fantastic, by the way. I want to see
that. Dane DeHaan and his girlfriend dies just around the time that the zombie apocalypse is starting to happen, and she comes back. And she's played by Aubrey Plaza. And her parents, I can't remember who the mother, but John C. Reilly is the father. No way. And so he's like, the thing is, she's back, and he's okay with it for a little while. But Life After Beth, that's an interesting movie that deals with the dead girlfriend coming back. The zombie girlfriend thing must have really caught on. You also have, what was the name of it?
Well, you know that one that was really awful was that Zombie Honeymoon. With the like,
Zombie Honeymoon is pretty wretched.
Pretty awful.
You had Life After Beth. You also had Burying the Ex, Joe Dante's movie with Anton Yelchin. Oh,
okay.
That one?
No, I kind of want to see it though.
It was pretty. I enjoyed it. It was not one of Joe Dante's better movies, but it was fun. For a long time, it was on Netflix. I'm not sure if it still is. Mm. And that would also, all these movies kind of fall into that gray zone of, they're not a full-blown horror film. Mm-hmm. They're really kind of a comedy with some dark edges.
Like I said, rom-com.
That's right. And there was one.
It's become a whole genre.
I've even got one on my list, too. I think it qualifies. We actually, you and I, saw this movie some years ago at the Maryland Film Festival.
Yeah.
A movie that never caught on.
Sadly, it was decent.
I personally think it's pretty good. It came out around the same time as a movie I actually absolutely abhor, and I'm not going to talk about much here, called Dead Girl.
Oh.
And I remember...
garbage.
Yeah, I remember one of the big websites was talking about Dead Girl and comparing it to this other film and saying how much better Dead Girl was, but no dice there for me. This movie is interesting because I think it's difficult to completely corner as a horror film, but it definitely has horror elements. It's definitely creepy. It feels like a coming-of-age movie.
Has a banging soundtrack.
It has a great soundtrack. It's called Make Out with Violence, and it's a movie that probably very few people have seen.
Mm-hmm.
For a long time, it was available on Netflix. I'm not sure if it is anymore, but it's a very interesting film. It's a harder movie to find. It was made by a couple of directors who called themselves the Deagle Brothers. They were not named Deagle, nor were they brothers, but they made this movie. I'm honestly not certain that they've made any other movies. There's a lot of interesting things going on. You have the Darling Brothers, who are...
Oh, yeah, because it has a strange...
It has a weird kind of Peter Panny thing going on, because the Darling Brothers move to this town, and they're really good friends with Wendy. One of them sort of obsessed with her, and it feels like a John Hughes movie as it gets going. And then Wendy wanders off, and she disappears, and no one can find her, and they don't know what's going on, and then one of them finds her tied to a tree, and she's a zombie now. That's really, there's no more explanation beyond that. But the film is dealing with how each of these kind of high schoolers on the cusp of things are dealing with the grief. There's a lot of time spent with the funeral, the aftermath of the funeral. How is it when you can't quite move on from somebody? They're still alive in your mind, even if they're still not alive physically. Mm-hmm. Now, Wendy's deal is that she's still alive, kind of, but not quite at the same time. And what's kind of destructive is how none of the characters can quite figure out where she's supposed to fit. I kind of think it's more interesting in some ways than some of the movies we mentioned, because it isn't that much about the zombie girl.
Mm-hmm.
There are some really gross scenes of them putting rats into smoothies. There's some gross scenes of people eating dogs.
Yes.
You know, there's some goriness under the surface, but at the heart of the movie, it is a coming-of-age story. It's also a learning-to-cope-with-death story.
Sort of, yeah.
And it's got a lot of neat facets. It's another one. It's not going to be for everybody. I'd not be so much because of how strong the content is, but because of how weird I think the movie is in general.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting. It's thoughtful. But it's unlike any zombie movie I've ever seen before. But I think the romantic angle really does work in this. I really feel like these kids, you get a hand, because we don't only see the relationship involving the Darling Brothers and Wendy, who's come back. We see Wendy's best friend and Wendy's boyfriend, and what is happening in the wake of her being gone.
All their relationship dynamics.
Yeah,
changing.
You see these people and what they're doing and how they interact with each other and the care they have for one another. And just like a John Hughes movie, you have several different characters that you're sort of connected with, mm-hmm. that you're sort of rooting for, that you want to see what's going to happen next. And I think that kind of propels the movie forward. I'm not quite entirely sure where you can find it. It used to be out there, again, streaming somewhere. So Make Out with Violence. Good luck.
That was a good one. So the next one... I kind of want to save one that I haven't talked about before for my first number one pick. So I want to go with this one, even though we have mentioned it before. It's fantastic, and I would have normally put that as my top pick because I love it so much. But I want to mention A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night. We've talked about it a couple of times on the podcast.
Great vampire movie, great romance movie.
Both of those elements are fantastic.
And that's on Netflix. You can watch it right now.
Absolutely. There's not much more to say than it's boy meets girl who may not be a girl, you know?
But not in that crying game sort of way.
No, no. I realize that sounds actually kind of creepy now that I mentioned that. Okay, so boy meets vampire. How about that? And all set up. It's all set in a bad town in what we presume to be some sort of Middle Eastern country.
Yeah.
Filled with prostitutes and drug dealers and all the various bad people you could possibly find.
This is a movie where the love story works. Like,
yes.
The movie cannot work without the love story in this case.
And it's very strong.
I don't think that that's true of any of the other movies we've talked about so far. This one, it wouldn't work without the love story.
It is absolutely the selling point of this movie. That's why I think it's probably the best out of the ones that I've mentioned, but I'll save something different for the end. So, I encourage you, if you haven't seen it, definitely check out A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night. We've covered it much more exhaustively on other podcasts, but definitely deserves a mention here.
Well, we're on the topic of the black and white and the horror movies, which is probably a good time to kind of just break off from the list a little bit and mention some that are out there. That I think really the reason most of these movies didn't end up on my list is simply that they're pretty well known. They're out there. As you've said, we've talked about a lot of them before in the past. But it's a good time to throw them out there because things will be, if you want a list of movies to check out, then really it's hard to go wrong with some of the old classic horror films.
Absolutely.
And not just the Universal movies, but the Universal movies. We've got the big remake of The Mummy coming out this summer. I have almost zero hope for that. But the 1930s version.
The Mummy meets the Transformers or whatever.
Run, it's essentially Tom Cruise, the same. Run.
Yeah.
And the original Mummy, the one with Boris Karloff from the 30s, it's a great love story.
It is.
And at the same time, it's a horror movie. It's both of those things. And Karloff is great in it. It's a visually sumptuous movie. There are a lot of really good versions of Phantom of the Opera out there. There's even the Claude Rains Universal movie that's actually in color and has a lot more opera than many horror fans are probably expecting. I personally like it a lot. Bride of Frankenstein, one of the all-time great...
Oh, that's
probably
classic.
The very top of my list in terms of romantic horror movies. Excellent. It really captures, I think, too, even though the bride herself is not, as the bride, is not in the film for very long, the final exchange in the movie and how it all ends. I don't think you capture that spurned high school love any better than what happens at the end of Bride of Frankenstein.
Yes.
But... that's such a great movie. A great movie for any time. And, of course, you've got Dracula, and if you go over to the Val Lewton side of things, you have the Cat People, which
is
excellent movie.
Excellent
masterpiece,
movie.
As far as I'm concerned. And really another love story, a movie that can't operate without the love story at the center of it. And much like Ugetsu, a very haunting story that depends upon casting a light on the role of women in society, and then how that itself can be kind of a horror story, depending.
Mm-hmm.
And that plays out in both of these movies, where some of the horror is just based in not having control because not so much of, you know, because of who you are and where you are at this point in history. So, an interesting kind of thoughtful stuff going on in those movies. So, that which kind of dovetails into my next movie, I've kind of lost sense of making these things... number one, number two, number three, four, in terms of, I'm sort of stream of consciousness, like, hey, they're out here. But my last two are both monster movies, in a similar sense of how those old black and white movies were. Monster movies where the romance was centered around the monster.
Mm-hmm.
And the first one's a really, relatively new film. I mean, really, it is a new film from about 2014. And I actually had the privilege of being able to interview these guys both for their first movie and for this movie. This movie was done 2014. It was Justin Benson and Aaron Moorhead. They did a movie called Spring.
Oh, yeah. And that was a crazy movie.
It's came out, what, 2014 or 2015? I know
it was 2015.
Making the rounds, yeah. And it's out there. It's available on VOD. It may even be on Amazon or Netflix streaming, possibly. I think Amazon Prime or Netflix. And this is a movie that has a lot of horror elements, but I think it verges almost more into dark fantasy or science fiction even a little bit. I don't know if you would say that's about right.
I'd say definitely more the like dark science fiction. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and
this it has a lot of heart to it, surprisingly.
This one really, the romance element of this is front and center. This is more romance than horror, I'd say. I mean, this is almost like Before Sunrise if it was written by H.P. Lovecraft. I mean, you're gonna get your weird...
And you do mean Lovecraft.
Yeah. There's a great monster here. There's a great romance here. There's great characters. I was into the characters here such a way that I don't think it mattered whether anything else happened in terms of... But this monster and the way the monster, what the monster is and what it represents is pretty compelling.
Yeah, like it's a very
cool
neat.
Kind of creature. If there's any kind of downside to it, it's just that there's not really a lot of horror here. This is really... For a lot of its running time, it's kind of upbeat. I mean, because it is a love story, it almost starts to develop that kind of love conquers all sort of mentality to a degree. And the monster elements, I don't think, are particularly scary, but they add something to the movie.
Oh yeah, they do.
I think it's
I think there's definitely some creepiness to it.
It's really good for. Particularly for being a movie like the second time out. These guys, I like their first movie, Resolution. I think Spring is a stronger movie. And it's a good...
I agree.
I think it feels mainstream enough, even though I don't know if a lot of people discovered it, that this is a good date night choice.
Pretty decent, yeah.
I mean, because you're going to walk away with the romance angle.
Personally, my favorite character in that whole movie is one you have not mentioned. The old Italian guy who just basically grunts the whole time.
who owns the vineyard there. Yeah. This movie's peopled with that sort of thing, though, where small characters who they just add to the ambiance and the texture of the movie. There's a lot of that. Like, but him wandering, like, this takes place in Italy.
Yeah.
And that element of the story is pretty prominent. I mean, there are scenes where there's characters wandering around museums or old cathedrals or vineyards, and it's just beautiful to look at on top of everything else.
There's a lot, like you said, there's a lot of texture to this movie.
Yeah, and there's a good monster story at the heart of the film.
Kind of fascinating. I kind of want a little more of that story.
That's the thing. I kind of walk away... Wanting more, but not so much to the point like
Evolution, where they give you little bits of the backstory, but just enough to tease your brain, but not enough to really...
You like what's going on here so much that you want to follow these characters a little further down the road. You're not quite convinced that this is all you have for me.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not a disappointed, I want a little more. It's a, I like that, how about well a little bit
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that was a great movie. I liked that a lot.
And for all you people who think Twilight's a romance... horror movie, go watch Spring,
please.
Sparkly vampires.
Whoever thought that was a good idea? I don't know, it made millions of dollars.
Chris, what else do you have? So are you...
I'm down to my top one, if you're ready for it.
Go for it, man.
This one's probably I don't think many people have seen, so I wanted to mention this one. The Signal. Similar to, actually, now that I think about it, I think this came out after The Signal, but Stephen King wrote a book called Cell, where basically there was this message going through people's phones, and they pick it up, they hear the signal from the phone, they turn into kind of like brainless zombie rage creatures running around destroying things.
Yeah, and you know what, it dawns on me that we're talking about The Signal. Technically, there's more than one movie called The Signal. This is the one from 2006, Chris? Is that
right? Sounds about right to me.
2004 or 5? Because there was one, and you and I saw it, The Signal from a few years ago, the alien one with Lawrence Fishburne, where they are...
Yes, yeah, that's also that's a different signal. One, sorry.
That's not the one.
That one was lousy.
It just dawned on me that there's more than one. No,
I should have clarified.
This is the better Signal.
I'm normally a Lawrence Fishburne fan, but that movie, not so much. Anyways, to this movie, The Signal, this version of The Signal... It's about a guy and a girl and the world gone mad as they try to find one another, essentially, like a guy and a girl. It is broken down into three like main segments of different stories, but they all kind of interconnect. I wouldn't really call it an anthology movie.
It's directed by different people. Each segment's directed by different people. Each segment has a different feel. It's three separate stories, but they form an arc.
And the arc of... the
main characters are in...
Exactly. The boy and the girl fall in love, and then they kind of... as the world starts falling apart from this mysterious signal that I think it comes through on the TVs at one point at night, they have to find each other again. And it's kind of like the basic arc of it. But it's... And the thing about this movie that's so crazy is just like... people go nuts on each other in this movie. Like
they do.
When they hit the, when the signal hits them and they just become violent, rage-filled things with no like regard for anything. And it's some of the nuttiest stuff I've seen.
Although the through line for the movie is interesting because much like a movie like 28 Days Later, even though you have everybody losing their junk and going crazy, the movie still centers on that some basic human emotion will still overcome this overarching madness, which in a way,
true,
a lot of the crazed zombies that are, I say zombies, they're not the living dead,
no,
the,
yeah,
but they're people who have lost all sense of being a person, mm-hmm, and they're running around just murdering each other in this frenzy. They're scary, but the guy who still has his wits about him, the kind, the A.J. Bowen character,
oh,
who
yeah,
is like the crazed, angry boyfriend, or husband, that guy who does everything methodically and in his right mind, he's mm-hmm far scarier.
Yes.
And he keeps his wits about him as he goes through, and he's far more dangerous to the main characters. And then the same idea that this, that love conquers all, it also seems that the movie's kind of just saying that that unfiltered emotion can also conquer this sort of wild, heat-of-the-moment rage that's going on. Mm-hmm. But the movie almost has, there's almost like, even though I'd say you're right, that all the segments are connected, they're not quite like an anthology, like these stories are happening unconnected, mm-hmm, disconnected, but each movie, each segment feels like a different movie in its tone.
It does.
Like, yeah, the first tone is a kind of crazy Night of the Living Dead, panic in the streets kind of story. Mm-hmm. The second one's like a horror comedy.
It
like
is.
Evil, yes, Dead sort of thing.
Nutty.
Just crazy, like very trippy and weird. And then the third segment is almost psychological horror in almost a Cronenberg-y kind of way. Like,
that's a good term, Cronenberg.
You know, like there's, yeah, moments in that last segment I feel like I'm watching Scanners or The Brood or something in the, mm-hmm, way that they're handling it. The tone becomes much, much stranger.
Yeah, I feel like I really need to rewatch this one because I enjoyed it a lot. And it was pretty strong, like it was pretty well put together.
Talking about it makes me want to go back.
I kind of want to rent it now.
Yeah, and like check it out again. It's a good one, and it's a good
look. If you haven't seen it, you should definitely check it out.
Yes, agreed.
Again, this is not The Signal starring Lawrence Fishburne.
No, This Signal is from 2007.
Okay.
And it's very interesting because a lot of the direct, David Bruckner, who worked on VHS, he directed some of the segments.
Oh, that makes sense.
And he had Dan Bush, and I think, who did the third segment. But the movie, I'm looking to see where it's like available, and you can get it on Amazon, but for a while it used to be on Netflix.
It was, I know that. Yeah.
If it's still there or not. But good movie, creepy movie for sure. Yeah, I think that it works well in the scheme of, I'm trying to think of how to say it. It's scary, it gets intense, but it never loses sight of the characters, which I think is
absolutely
the romantic element. So yeah, this is definitely a horror movie. There's no getting around. You can't really paint this as a different genre. There's some crazy horror movie stuff that happens.
Yes.
But, so, I guess that brings me to mine, and I realize now that I actually technically have six movies, so we're going to have to call this one a tie.
All right, that's fair.
I think that these are just great movies in general. They also, much like Ugetsu, I think that they transcend some easy horror movie tag, but I think both of these probably fit into the genre much more easily than like Ugetsu. So I said that, you know, I was thinking number one, monster movie. This would probably be number one with a bullet. The other movie here, I personally think is a great movie. Some people might be back and forth on how much of a horror movie is it. But number one for me, first choice, The Fly.
With Jeff Goldblum. I love that one.
And we talk about Cronenberg.
Yeah.
Cronenberg did this.
And Cronenberg-y, and as you recall, there was a great scene with Jeff Goldblum saying, I got two words for you. Cheeseburger.
It's a good romantic horror movie, even though it's pretty ghastly. This movie is more, the Brundlefly. What happens? Watching somebody suffer in the way that the Goldblum character suffers, while he's still the villain of the piece, he's one of by far the most sympathetic monsters I've ever seen in a movie. He's still motivated by love, but he's starting to lose his mind, and he's this man of science. And what happens to him incidentally. It doesn't make you fear him any less as he becomes the monster, but you feel really bad for him. I can't... Mm-hmm. There's kind of like a just tragic, really sadness to the movie. I'm very like touched by it when I've seen it in the past. I'd love to rewatch it, but the relationship between Gina Davis is legitimately good. Why can't more people figure out what to do with Goldblum?
Yes, like, to use him. In he's such so a way. Awesome.
Like
he's so based good
on what he does in The Fly. I mean, he's always good, but he's become this weird sort of like
hipster commodity actor.
Yeah, he's like something that people like they parade him about like a white elephant, and then bring him back out. The Fly is a great case for why Goldblum should be the star of more movies.
Yeah.
And, I mean, now he kind of makes fun of that sort of weird, off-kilter, seductive thing he does with the book. But he plays it for real in The Fly, and it's creepy.
It's effective.
And it works. And a great monster. A gross monster. and a sad movie. I mean, I genuinely think The Fly is as good, or if not better... Most of the black and white horror movies we've mentioned. It belongs up there with The Mummy.
I'd say that's fair. Like that. Yeah.
It's more gross.
Oh,
it's
much
definitely
more
visceral. It's definitely more intense. And I'm pretty sure it is available on one of the streaming networks right now. And
most likely.
Great movie. The other
The
film,
Fly 2, on the other hand.
Not so much. you could, and you know, I don't think it's as much a love story, but you could always go back and watch the old Fly. With
no, that's Price. Got some
that's
great.
That's a fun little movie too. Yeah. It's not on the same level. My other movie that's tied here is a Danish movie called The Vanishing. The Vanishing.
Ah, another tragic
Dutch
tale
film, I think. And it's really good. It's very different. It's not a horror movie. I think of what we typically think of a horror. I'd say it probably verges on thriller. Maybe a little bit more. But it also has a really deep existential vibe to it.
Absolutely.
Basically have a character, two, not sure if they're married or their boyfriend or girlfriend, but they're traveling across, I think they're married, they're traveling across country. They kind of get upset with each other at one point. He kind of leaves her, their car breaks down a tunnel, he leaves her and walks out, she's screaming. He comes back, he gets her, they get out of the tunnel fine. But shortly thereafter, at a rest stop, she disappears, and he never sees her again. And he becomes obsessed with the fact that he can never find her, and that things have sort of left at this point of contention between them. And it kind of just rips his life apart. He tries to put it back together to no avail. Thing that's a standout about this movie is most thrillers would sort of have you trying to figure out, well, what exactly happened to the girl? But we know almost up front that it's nothing good because... Within, 10 minutes of the film starting, we know who abducted her.
Yes.
We meet this guy who also seems to just be living a normal kind of family life, except for this one aberrant thing that he's done. And watching these two worlds collide, this guy who's becoming deeply obsessed and this guy who's decided to kind of... I'm trying to think of how he characterizes it, just to see the power of life over death. You know, I think he has a moment where he saves somebody and he's fascinated by that. He wants to do the flip side, which is kind of step out and harm somebody's life. There's a lot of stuff going on.
To balance the scales.
It's a crazy movie, but it's also a really heartfelt, poignant movie. I feel like this is a really strong movie where, and if romance is the right word, but love is definitely the center of this movie in a real way, not in a sort of...
Very tragic way. Yeah.
Great movie, I think. Chris, what'd you think about The Vanishing?
It's true. The first time I watched it, I didn't care for it as much because I was anticipating more of a horror film. But going back and reflecting on it, it was very... It had some very dark and sinister and creepy elements to it, while at the same time being very psychological. I liked it. I thought it was interesting. This is the 88 one, right?
Yeah, yes, the 88. It's funny because George Slusser, the director, remade his own movie in 1993 with Kiefer Sutherland, Jeff Bridges, and Sandra Bullock, and Nancy Travis, and it's garbage. It's funny because he basically did everything you wouldn't want someone to do to your work, and he did it to his own movie, and he made it Money Americanized. Talks. It was almost like he thought the Americans will like this better. Every little bit of subtlety, the way
stripped away from it,
the way that the character, the serial killer-esque character in the original Vanishing, feels like a plausible, normal family man. You know, you can't pinpoint why this guy is what he is. Jeff Bridges' character, Jeff Bridges is a fantastic actor, but in The Vanishing, he plays a creepy, dirty-looking, hobo-ish-looking guy who is like every version of the creepy killer you could ever imagine, you know?
Yeah.
It's down the line, it hits every expected cliche, and it makes...
That's sad.
Yeah, yeah. So, honestly, it's the... I think we've got a pretty good batch of movies there. There's a lot of ones we probably didn't mention that we could have.
I had one I did want to mention because it does definitely fits this theme. It's one movie I actually don't like at all, but it's so perfect for this particular list that I wanted to mention as one that it's not our favorite, but it kind of fits.
Go for it, man.
So, and I know amongst horror fans, for whatever reason, it's pretty popular, probably because it is so kind of grotesque, but Audition, if you've ever seen that.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, so that's the ultimate psycho girl, girlfriend kind of relationship.
We shouldn't even say, if you haven't seen this movie, we really shouldn't even say too much more about it because it's so nuts.
I will say this. The first half of the movie, and I do mean first half, because it takes a while to unfold.
Yes. This is a tonal shift unlike anything I've ever seen.
It is totally two different movies. It's crazy. The first half of the movie is the most sweet, charming, and crazy little premise. Like
we talk about romantic comedies. This is legitimately a romantic comedy for, like you said, about 45 minutes.
Yes. And it's like, why is this a horror movie as I'm watching? Like, what is going on? And then it dramatically shifts in a way I was not anticipating at all. And lots of horrible, grotesque things happen, which is why I'm not a huge fan of it. But
I can tell you why people like it. It's because it is a kick in the face. Some people kind of a horror movie. It's dreadfully effective. I mean, I wanted to walk out. I did walk out of this when I saw it the first time. I saw it in 2001 at there's a anime convention. Otakon used to happen here in Baltimore. They moved it to DC now. Mm. But in 2001, I remember going there, and I'm not really into anime, so I went with a couple friends that were, and I just went like to the live action room and kind of.
That's where I would always go because that was the fun room. You get to watch some Japanese.
So movies. I walk in, and I don't know what movie was supposed to be playing, but the schedule had become ransacked at this point, and whatever I thought I was there to watch. I sat down and didn't know I was watching Audition. So
happens at Otakon.
So I knew that...
Changing their schedules all the time.
I knew that the director, Kishi Miyake, is a guy known for very strong, very over-the-top stuff sometimes. Yes. But I didn't know...
Weirdly, and then sometimes kids' movies.
Well, that kind of came later, but yeah. Around this time it was like Ichi the Killer and Desert Q, and movies I knew were just way out there. And I was watching Audition without realizing that this was Audition. So... They're going to go and play all kinds of different movies. And so I thought we were legitimately watching a romantic kind of movie in the vein of a movie I love. Shall We Dance, a Japanese film that deals with, you know, this. The premise is you've got this a widower who his wife has died. He's kind of raised his son. Son's at a point where like, Dad, you know what? You've taken good care of me.
You need to
get back in the dating game.
Yeah.
He doesn't really know how. He's very shy. After his wife died, he just stayed out with someone. He doesn't even know really how to approach women. So he has this director friend of his sort of set up what's supposed to be an audition for a movie. But he's using it as an audition for the girl he wants to date. Yeah. It sounds cute, but is really misogynistic on the other hand.
Yeah, it's also kind
of
crazy.
And then horrible, you know, like then the tone eventually changes, and it's brutal in the way it shifts. I mean, yes. You suddenly sit there, and I felt like I had been kidnapped and taken into another movie. And I'm sitting here thinking, I don't want to see this. I don't want to see this. I don't want to see this. I don't want to see it. It's not going to happen. That just happened. And that's time. And I walked out, and then yes. I felt like, I'm like, you know what? No, I can do this. And I walked back in, and I wish I hadn't.
Yeah.
And I finished it, but I wished I hadn't finished it.
Yeah, it is a nasty movie. It's not my cup of tea, but it kind of fits the theme of this show so perfectly. I had to mention it.
No, there are people out there. I'm not necessarily one of them, but there's that element of horror where you kind of want to be kicked around a little. You want to be
the teeth in the case of this one.
Some people really like that. Wow, this is strong, and this is what I want. If that's you, if you were just feeling a little twisted, auditions.
Yeah. Or if you're especially bitter about the holiday.
That's very true, too. So, well, you can check out. We'll have all of our choices and recommendations in the show notes for the episode. Thanks for listening. We'll be back soon with a kind of more regular weekly episode and discuss a little bit more what's going to be going on the podcast for 2017. And thanks for listening. Everyone, have a great Valentine's Day.
See you guys. Care.
We hope you enjoyed tonight's cast, and we hope that you'll join us again when Phantom Galaxy returns with a brand new episode. If you wish to contact us, you can email us at phantomcasts@gmail.com. We're also available. You can find us on phantomgalaxy.podbean.com, and our episodes are also going up over at popcultureninja.podbean.com. All of the music in tonight's episode comes from Lithuanian artist Stellar Drone, whose ambient electronica creates soundscapes that are both haunting and fascinating to listen to. Stellar Drone's music is actually available for free on the internet in a couple of different places. You can find his Facebook page under Stellar Drone on Facebook, and you can also find all of his albums available on stellardrone.bandcamp.com. Until next time, this is Nathan Parabol with the Phantom Galaxy.